This is the story of how your story was created. We each create a narrative for ourselves throughout our lives, starting from our very earliest experiences within our mother's wombs. This narrative becomes the blueprint we use to carry out the building of our life story, until eventually we believe that it's set in stone, immutable. The narrative includes our sense of self-esteem, our sense of efficacy, our sense of trust, and our sense of worth. Even before you were born, you experienced life. You were affected by the well-being of your mother and of the significant others around her, probably your father, but maybe other family members or close friends as well. If you've ever been asked by a medical or mental health practitioner to complete a full developmental history for yourself, or more likely for your child, you may have wondered why on earth you were being asked questions about the mother's pregnancy and the birth experience. Here's why. A mother's physical health affects prenatal development, of course. If the mother was well nourished, well rested, and otherwise healthy, her baby has a physical advantage. If the mother was poorly nourished, or if she ingested substances that are harmful to a developing fetus, there may be some degree of harm to the baby. If the mother's in a state of reasonable health emotionally, that serves the baby well too. But if the mother's often under a lot of emotional distress, the baby can be affected negatively. Did she want to be pregnant at that time? How confident did she feel about giving birth and raising a child? Did the mother have significant others in her life that she felt were supportive of her and of her pregnancy? Did she have any problems with mental health that affected her in a significant way emotionally, such as anxiety or depression? It's now well known that a person who experiences chronic distress has an overload of the so-called stress hormones running through their system, and that this overload creates and perpetuates their sensitivity to distress. A developing fetus is also subjected to this stress bath, and will tend to exhibit the same sensitivities after birth. In addition, the new studies of epigenetics are suggesting that there may also be effects of inherited or ancestral trauma to consider. Then there's your birth experience. Was your birth unusually traumatic? I say unusually because it's got to be something of a shock to the system for any baby to endure the process of birth, even in the most ideal of circumstances. Were you born prematurely? Or at full term? Were there any complications during or shortly after your birth? If so, what kinds of intervention were needed, and what were the outcomes? What do you know about the circumstances of your own mother's pregnancy with you? What do you know about the circumstances of your birth? You'll only know consciously whatever you've been told, of course, though the hidden parts of your consciousness have always known and kept a record of this, creating the very first data points you have for the formation of your story. As an infant, you subconsciously began collecting more information about yourself and the limited view of the world around you. How did your mother and father and other caregivers interact with you? Did they smile at you? Talk to you lovingly? Hold and cuddle you? Respond to your distressed cries for food or comfort promptly? The way your primary caregivers responded to and initiated contact with you as a baby gave you very strong messages about your safety and your lovableness. And so your story may begin with these themes. I am safe. I am loved, and therefore lovable. Or conversely, I am not safe. I am not loved, and therefore unlovable. When you became a toddler and more aware of the differences between yourself and others. You got more information about yourself and the world you experienced. The people in your life who spent the most time with you became like mirrors for you. Their responses to your increasing independence and self-agency became the reflection by which you started to see yourself. As you acquired and used your new skills, how did those closest to you respond? Were they generally encouraging, delighted, reasonably patient, firm but loving in their correction and guidance of you? When you toddled away from your mother's side in the grocery store, how did she respond? When you shouted, "No!" at your father, what was his reaction? When you dumped a box of building blocks into the toilet and flushed it to see what would happen, what did your parents do? The way your primary caregivers and other frequent faces in your world responded to you generally gave you more information, more data, to tell you what you could expect from others in response to your actions. You started to learn what elicited approval and what elicited disapproval. The messages about your own safety and lovableness were reinforced by the reflections of yourself that you saw in the mirrors that these other people held. Although you surely wouldn't have known it in this early stage of your life, and maybe you're only just now beginning to realize it, not all mirrors are created equal. Very few human mirrors, the grown-up ones at any rate, are free of distortion. So the reflections of yourself that you may have seen in them would not have been fully accurate all the time. Some of these mirrors may reflect the light of you more brightly, radiantly, while others may only have given a dim reflection because they're darkened themselves. Some mirrors may offer a clean, flat surface, but others may be wavy and kind of wonky, like the ones that produce the gross distortions you see in a funhouse mirror. In other words, it could be that the reflections you saw of yourself and that you took to be accurate weren't showing you what was actually true about you. As you became a bit older, entering preschool or other activities with children near your age who were not your siblings, you gained even more experience of yourself and others. You learned more to compare and contrast. You noticed what you perceived, or were taught, to be differences between yourself and others. I'm a girl, and Mommy's a girl, and Miss Ashley's a girl. Jason's a boy, and Daddy's a boy. Deborah smiles and gives hugs, but Jennifer cries a lot, and she bites people. I don't bite people. Not only did you start to compare yourself to others, but you also compare the responses you got from particular people to the responses others got from those same people. When Deborah hugs Miss Ashley goodbye, Miss Ashley gives her a big hug back. But when I hug Miss Ashley goodbye, she just gives me a little hug back. How did your parents and other caregivers respond to you and to your siblings? How did your school teachers respond to you and to your classmates? How did your playmates and friends respond to you, and how did they appear to respond to your peers? Most children at this stage become acutely aware of what they perceive to be fair or unfair about the way they experience being treated. Children who are more emotionally advanced at this stage are also acutely aware of what they perceive to be fair and just, or unfair and unjust treatment of others as well. Other factors come into play at this stage of life. The wider variety of responses you received from others as a young child may have reinforced or diminished the reflected images you held of yourself, or they may have caused you some confusion. In addition, the correction and guidance you received at this stage, whether given gently or harshly, underlined the values you were being taught by the authority figures in your life, whether subtly or overtly. Yet another factor is the experience you had of yourself. You were learning many new skills, and you were independently demonstrating certain qualities about yourself. These demonstrations may have reinforced the reflected beliefs about yourself or contradicted them. For instance, when you helped someone or shared your toys at school, you demonstrated to yourself that you could be helpful or kind, even though your older sister at home had just called you mean and selfish for not letting her play with your favorite toy. The frequency and strength of the evidence you received from your own thoughts and actions could help to balance the degrees of reinforcing or contradictory messages you received from others. These kinds of experiences would have continued for you throughout your childhood, with more and more evidence to support or contradict your beliefs about yourself, others, and the world around you. For some reason, though, human beings form biases fairly early, and so we learn to pay more attention and give more credence to what supports our beliefs, whether those beliefs are beneficial or detrimental to our sense of well-being, than we do to what contradicts or challenges them. For example, if you had by this time come to see yourself as a shy, awkward child who wasn't welcome to walk over to a group of classmates on the playground or to join their game or their conversation, you might actually have missed the signals from the other children inviting you to join them. Or if you'd come to see yourself as someone who was a good little worker and helper at home and at school, you might feel guilty, or even like a fraud, in the times whenever you didn't really want to work or help. Or if you'd been told repeatedly that you were lazy and didn't try hard enough, despite the fact that you knew you were trying hard, but just couldn't seem to achieve the result that you or the others wanted, you may eventually have become resigned to the labels of lazy and not good enough and stopped trying much at all. During adolescence, the awareness of one's peers is at its height and is of supreme importance in the game of comparisons. It's also very natural at this time that teens start to question the stories they've made and accepted so far. Lots of people talk about teenage rebellion and how awful it is. Child development specialists tell us it's a difficult but necessary stage for the adolescent to be able to achieve individuation. And that very well may be, but I think it's really more about a stage of self-awareness that allows a teen to step back a bit from the narrative that's been developed so far and examine how much of it she wants to claim and keep and how much of it she needs to reject. And so the teen questions the values they've been taught, those judgments about what's important and what's not, judgments about what's good or bad, fair or unfair, proper or improper, etc. The ways in which the authority figures in the teen's life respond to this questioning has a strong influence on a teen's self-image, either strengthening or weakening parts of the teen's story in progress. If the teen's questioning of values is met with strong disapproval, especially if it's harsh, the teen might finally internalize a belief that they're wrong and incapable of deciding anything for themselves. Or perhaps they come to see themselves as bad, rejectable, rejected. And so they throw themselves into the role of outcast. Goth, anyone? Some teens have a sense of self that's strong enough to enable them to endure the disapproval as they pursue their weighing of values, and they'll reach their own conclusions, for the time being, anyway. Some versions of the story that we try out aren't sustainable, so they'll fall away and be replaced by a revised version. What was your own experience like when you were a teen starting to question or test the values of your family or communities? There's a lot of testing, experimenting, and trying on of identities during adolescence. All of this is completely normal and actually healthy. It's probably quite safe to assume that everyone who has survived their own teenage years recalls having some degree of difficulty getting through them. For most people who do experience a spontaneous unilevel disintegration, as described by Dabrowski, adolescence is the first time of life that it usually occurs. For those who have the capacity to move into the advanced levels of development in Dabrowski's model, stages 3 through 5, that experience may feel even more intense. No matter what else is going on for the teen, this time of questioning and experimenting is an unsettled one. While unpredictability and spontaneous flip-flops can feel exciting for short times, we humans don't do well with prolonged periods of that because it eventually causes us too much distress. Even as adults, we crave answers, solutions, and comprehension of our experiences. Yes, those with the judging preference in their personality type will crave it sooner than the perceivers, but both J's and P's have a need to land somewhere at some point. So we continue to have a desire to reach some conclusion about ourselves. We want to have a story that we feel is familiar and true, even if it doesn't necessarily bring us peace and joy. And how better to solidify the supposed truth of our story than to enroll others in it so that they can act it out with us again and again and again. As adults, we feel like we've settled into our stories. We continue to reinforce what we believe to be true, and we continue to cast others into roles that will provide us with evidence that our story really is what we've made it. We don't do this consciously, of course. So we don't question the patterns we've created. The story seems to run automatically. We may not be happy with some, or even most, of the story we're living. And we may even suffer greatly at times as a result. But until we examine the story consciously and choose to make revisions, the story will continue to run us. What are the stories that run your life?